ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Webb, and this is Not the Science Show. This is a special summer bonus episode, the first of five science extras that we'll be dropping into the Science Show podcast in coming weeks, in between your regular science shows with your regular Robin Williams. I'll be looking back at the year we've had in science, in environment news and health and technology, with some of our specialist reporters that we have in the RN Science Unit. First up, I'm looking back at 2023 in environment news with Dr. Anne Jones from What the Duck.
Morning.
And by Peter de Cruyff, who is our environment reporter in the science unit. Hello, Pete.
G'day.
We can't really do a review of environment news without touching on the story of our times, which was again the story of this year with records falling and new levels being set in lots of parts of the world, which of course is climate change. The climate continues to change and faster, if anything, Pete. Do you have any reflections among the various records that fell around the world about kind of new benchmarks that were set this year in that field in particular?
It's pretty easy to get bogged down by all the numbers in climate. I guess that overwhelming feeling is that things are getting hotter faster, things that feel like they're speeding up. To run over some of the main ones, though, the past 8 years, the warmest on record, that was something the World Meteorological Organization came out with at the start of the year, and that's despite the cooling influence of those La Ninas we've had over the last 3 years, which is that kind of cooler weather. We get more rainfall in places like Australia. It's a sort of phenomenon that happens in the Pacific Ocean. July was very hot. July was the hottest month we've ever had in the global temperature record, and it was about 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial temperature averages, and that's that time period from about 1850 to 1900 prior to when we really started taking off with fossil fuels. That's that kind of benchmark that's used for all our different climate targets. And from there, each month since has been a record month.
A record month as in even more than 1.5 above?
No, a record month compared to, say, the previous June, the previous October. So October was sort of the hottest October, but nothing's been able to eclipse that July period yet.
Yeah, right. And yeah, 1.5 is one of those benchmarks that global agreements are trying to stop us from breaching, but we're already starting to punch through it.
There's been a couple of reports this year around how much of a carbon budget we have left, and that's how much carbon we can keep putting up into the atmosphere to avoid really baking in that 1.5 degrees and a consistent 1.5 degrees, because we're already estimated in the next 4 years that we'll probably have an entire year where we're over 1.5 degrees, but it's where we start having that year after year over a long period of time. That's what we're trying to avoid at the moment, but we've probably got about 6 years left on our current sort of emissions rate, which isn't spectacular.
Yeah, that's quite the challenge, hey. And you mentioned El Nino, and it took a while, but eventually the Bureau of Meteorology here in Australia officially declared that we were in an El Nino pattern. What exactly does that mean for the summer we are heading into?
We're already on track to have our hottest year ever, 2023. And just coming into summer, climate scientists can't say as to whether or not next year will in fact be much hotter, but the possibility is there that that will be one of our warmer ones, and it could be one of those years that the meteorological organisation is sort of warning about, where we do kind of go over that 1.5. So it's a bit of a wait and see, but there's already been, you know, fires over in Western Australia. You've got that crossover now between the northern and southern fire seasons in that state. So it's looking like it's going to be very warm. It is a traditionally warm period for Australia, not as much rainfall. It's going to be hot.
Yeah. And you had the pleasure this year, the kind of unusual opportunity to travel around the Pacific a little bit for work. You shot an amazing TV series looking at environmental action in different parts of the Pacific. What did you learn about sort of Pacific attitudes and actions on climate change while you were traveling?
Yeah, it was a real privilege for me to travel to Tonga to shoot a project called Project Wild, which is available on ABC iView. And, well, the first thing I learned was how little I know about the Pacific Islands. And the second thing that I learned was about how really Tongan people really bring to life that slogan of think big, act small. Everything in Tonga was all about family and next door neighbours, providing for family and next door neighbours. So say on the main island in Tonga, Tongatapu, there was hit by a tsunami, it was probably about 18 months ago now, and I met this amazing woman called Maricela, who is a community leader in her own community. It got completely cut off from the rest of the island by this tsunami, right? And her whole community had to be self-sufficient. It made them realise several things about how they'd been growing food locally, but also what they needed to do in terms of vegetation in their area. So I actually went out and did a tiny little step with Maricela and people from her community in planting trees and things like that. And it really spurred me on to take those small actions in my own life. Because those numbers, you know, like Pete was just saying, those numbers are just so scary and so overwhelming, and it's really hard to sort of digest what you're meant to do. So yeah, start small.
Especially as a, you know, as a small nation that'll be on the front line of the environmental effects, but maybe doesn't feel like they have the size of levers to pull on to take action that some of the bigger countries have.
Yeah, but they're also a lot more aware of it. And like, you know, in some ways it's such an enviable lifestyle, it's really easy to romanticise other people's lives, as you know.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, they often have these most amazing fertile gardens. So there was this volcano, it caused a tsunami, this was very bad. But what came after the volcano was a period of death in everything because there was ash all over all the plants. But then the ash turned into fertiliser essentially. And the whole island is just bananas, like literally bananas everywhere.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Yeah, so it's like a really interesting sort of timeline, how a disaster can bring strength in different ways.
Yeah, fascinating. And if we zoom back out to the global problem, Pete mentioned the carbon budget, 6 years. If we keep emitting the way we are, we've got 6 years before we will really breach this, the 1.5 limit, wasn't it, Pete? You say is obviously it will be the first one to go. That requires a massive energy transition, and that requires renewable technology, which in itself takes a lot of building and takes quite a lot of resources. And that's something you've been looking into, Pete, is the conflict between the transition, which is about saving the planet, and the protection of local environments, which are in danger from mining, in particular, the bottom of the sea.
And so we're looking at all these places maybe that we haven't looked to get minerals from before or haven't been of as much economic value. And that's where these sort of deep sea deposits coming to the fore. And there's not a lot of regulation around that. And there's been an interesting kind of thing happening over the past few years when Nauru, which is quite a poor country, a Canadian metals company has sort of come through them, and they're trying to get a mining project going in the Pacific. And they sort of tried to force the hand of this international organization about 2 years ago if they didn't have regulations in place by the middle of this year that they would have gone ahead with a mining project. But that's all sort of been put on pause now. The can's been kicked down the road till 2025 now.
Right, but, so but the can's been kicked down the road. They can't mine in the meantime?
It's still quite grey,
right.
Not looking like it's going to happen, but there's lots of different pressures around this. China has some interests in this space. At the same time, there's a lot of big companies that are mobilising against it as well. There's about 20 countries, including France, the UK, which are sort of against this, and big companies too, Samsung, Google, car companies like BMW, they're not wanting to use materials from there. And that's because we just don't know a lot. We don't know a lot about these spaces at all. You know, there's a lot more expeditions going into deep sea expeditions now, but we just don't understand a lot about these environments. And one of the most interesting kind of elements that people are looking to mine are these big magnesium nodules, bumps on the ocean, like little buttons everywhere.
Just sort of lying around on the floor of the ocean.
On the floor, they've taken millions of years to form. And so they can be rich in some of these materials that are needed. But I mean, I remember talking to some of the deep sea explorers earlier this year, looking over in the Indian Ocean, and there's just so much life around some of these habitats. And we're seeing different studies just as to how many different species are being found. You know, there's hundreds of species. Many of them haven't even been identified scientifically through the museum's taxonomical process. And we're only starting to get bits of research now as to what different impacts could be. So there was a recent one around what mining could do to, say, the pelagic or helmet jellyfish, a fairly common jellyfish, deep sea jellyfish found all around the world, can be about 4,000 metres deep up to the surface. It's a bit hardier than other creatures, which are a bit more gelatinous and kind of melt in the warmer temperatures of the surface.
As a jellyfish, it's a tough one.
Yeah, as far as jellyfish go, yeah.
But the mining, you know, is very disruptive, so it could have an effect even for a big and important species like that.
And it's all those flow-on effects then, but they basically took some of these jellyfish, put them into a tank, fed a bunch of sediment into those tanks, muddy water, and the jellyfish started producing all this mucus so it could get rid of the sediment and not be impacted by it. But then the concerns of the researchers is that takes energy in a big dark place, the bottom of the ocean where you need, you know, energy is crucial. That's going to impact what's happening with your diet. You might starve. That can impact reproduction rates and then just kind of go up the chain.
So stirring up sediment generally in the ocean probably going to have some consequences for lots of these species.
I mean, even just the removal of the nodules where, you know, something that's part of a habitat that takes millions of years to form, you're going to take millions of years to have the same habitat come back.
Yeah, if we're going to build our EVs, those minerals have to come from somewhere. It's interesting that you say some of the big car companies are saying they don't want to be associated with deep sea mining necessarily. And you're a big nature fan. I'm guessing there are some things down deep that you'd like to learn more about before we necessarily start hoovering magnesium globules off the bottom of the ocean.
I mean, it is the most alien environment we have on Earth, right? This is the furthest away from a human-friendly place that you could possibly think of, except maybe the top of Everest, right? And that necessarily means that we basically don't know anything about what's going on down there. You can put hydrophones down, listen to all of these sounds, and you're like, wait a second, what is making that sound? You know, there's all sorts of knocks and bops and things, and it's all mysteries. So when we go into an environment that we really don't know too much about and we start to make big changes, it does have big risks attached to it.
So if we turn from the depths of the ocean to the skies and the land, I guess, the transition of pathogens, of bugs from animals to humans, is it much more of a going concern than it was a few years ago, having seen the ravages that COVID wrought on the planet? And you've been looking a little bit at the potential impacts of bird flu in particular.
Yeah, it's not something I want to look into, but it's something that all of my acquaintances in the environmental field, all of my friends who are interested in wildlife are really concerned about. Because there's been increasing accounts all over the world, well, almost all over the world, of highly pathogenic bird flu. So this is H5N1. You might remember that from sort of the 2000s and the 90s when bird flu, there was a big outbreak that happened in Asia. Now, bird flu, this highly pathogenic one, which means that it basically spreads really quickly, has spread through Asia, Africa and Europe, jumped over into North America and made its way all the way down to Patagonia. Now, the only places that this highly pathogenic strain isn't being found at the moment is Antarctica and Australia. So we've got 67 countries, something like 131 million domestic birds, so domestic poultry, have had to be slaughtered because of this.
Wow.
So this is of huge concern, not just for the agricultural arena, but also the environmental arena, because what's actually happened is H5N1, we call it bird flu or avian influenza, but it can actually infect other creatures. There's been a huge amount of thousands and thousands of sea lions that have died in Peru and Chile. It's been found in Chilean dolphins. Whole colonies, as in tens of thousands of birds, of pelicans in South America have died. Now, it has actually jumped to humans a couple of times, in fact, more than a couple, something like eight, possibly more times since 2021. So that's in a fairly short amount of time. Now, there's been four people who've died of it in Cambodia just this year. So just because it's jumped into humans doesn't mean it's easily spread in humans. So that's one little flag to put up to make sure that people aren't like immediately panicking. But it has been found in domestic cats, in foxes, otters, mountain lions, bears, dolphins, ferrets, like almost you name it. Now, what this impact could be if it does get to Australian shores could be dreadful, not just for the poultry industry, but also for our wild birds. When we have tens of millions of birds across Australia, and not all of them actually have defences against H5N1, which is sort of surprising. You think they would.
The clue's in the name, bird flu. You would think they might have had some exposure to it over the course of evolution, but not in our corner of the world, is that right?
Not necessarily in our corner of the world. Now, we've got heaps of migration of birds that happens, you know, north and west and like all over the shop, right? But actually, we're really relatively isolated from the rest of the world, especially when you consider how densely packed Europe's birds might be, you know, like in close proximity to each other, whereas ours, even in Australia, can be really separated. So the black swans, for example, from over Perth, the WA state bird, versus the black swans over on the east coast might have actually relatively little to do with each other. They live in relative isolation.
Right.
Now, that means that, you know, things like big bird flu epidemics might have swished past them in their evolutionary road. And black swans in particular have been found to have zero immunity, not one piece of immunity to H5N1. And this was found out because to, you know, the Northern Hemisphere, black swans are a like really weird thing because they have white swans and they think that black swans are really weird.
So
they
have these, never seen them before, yeah.
They have these swans that they take and put in their, you know, lakes and stuff. And as bird flu's gone through, the swans die almost immediately. Within a day, they die. So they have none. It's absolutely incredible. Now, they've found that they actually have the gene, but it's not switched on in their DNA. And that's research that comes out of WA and Dr. Parwinder Kerr, who is this amazing geneticist who has taken on the plight of our black swans.
Very vulnerable.
Yeah. If this strain hits our water birds, we could lose Australia's black swan population within a matter of weeks.
That's terrifying. Is there any way we can stop it coming to Australia? Or given all of the migration of birds that we have that you mentioned, is it just a matter of time?
That question just gave me the chills. So what we can do as humans is we can make sure that when we are handling birds and if we're importing, exporting birds, that we're taking lots and lots of precautions, right? So when we're handling birds, you need to be making sure that your birds are healthy.
Yep.
And at the first sign of anything, you're getting advice on how to take action. But you're right. It's terrifying. But what I take heart in, right, is the fact that these international migrations have been going literally for tens of thousands of years. And so one hopes and prays, I suppose, that it doesn't hit our shores.
Hope and pray. And look after your poultry and stay alert for sick birds.
Yeah. Absolutely. So if you do find any sick birds, there's a bit of an event that's been going on in recent months with shearwaters, where lots of shearwaters have been washing up dead. Now, if you do find a dead wild bird that looks like it has been ill, then you need to call your local wildlife authorities and don't touch it with bare hands.
And while we're on glimmers of hope, I like that from you, Anne. Pete, you had one as well this year, a story people may have missed, which was some good news coming from the Amazon rainforest for a change.
Yeah, well, it's been a bit of a sad state of affairs with the Amazon over the past few years. It kind of got to the point where it was more carbon was going into the air from deforestation than was sort of being stored by this, you know, great biome that's known as the lungs of the planet, right? But funnily enough, a change in political fortunes has led to, well, the first time in 5 years, it's sort of this 5-year low for deforestation from the Brazilian side of things. So Bolsonaro, the former president, was replaced by a fellow called Lulu, and his political bid was to stop deforestation by 2030. And so it's been a lot less.
A five-year low. Does that mean are they on track to stop altogether by 2030, or is a five-year low just a bit of a dip?
Well, it's a dip. Colombia's also gone for a slight dip. They've also had a bit of a change in politics there as well. Unfortunately, there was kind of a meeting of the countries that have a stake within the Amazon, and so that kind of push by Brazil for this 2030, you know, ceasing of deforestation didn't quite get a full commitment from everyone. There's a bit of division around oil extraction, so, you know, always very complicated political situations and even just, you know, trying to maintain and grow your country in certain levels of life. But you know, it's paused, and it's certainly a change from that kind of widespread clearing we were seeing for things like, you know, cattle production, which can, of course, put more methane into the air and those sort of things.
Exactly, yeah. Taking out rainforest and putting in cattle grazing is sort of a 1-2 punch for emissions into the atmosphere, isn't it? So good to have a step in the right direction.
Yep.
Thanks, Pete. Peter de Kruijf is the environment reporter in our ABC Science unit, and Dr. Anne Jones is our resident nature nerd and presents What the Duck here on RN. Thank you both for your time.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Thanks, Jonathan.
That's it for this bonus download of The Science Show. Come back next week when we'll be looking at the year in technology, including the exciting or terrifying rise of artificial intelligence, depending on how you look at it. I'm Jonathan Webb. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.